14. Roy was leaning heavily on the canyon wall, muttering to himself and looking ruefully around the corner at the fortifications of Castle Cragganmore. Britt and Gwen were leaning on the wall, looking ruefully at Roy. Roy could see the castle, the soldiers in front of it, the raging river surrounding it, the steep canyon walls containing the river. And a third of the way up the canyon wall, he could see a lone figure emerging from behind the castle, making his way back toward his position.
"I can see Martin," Roy said. "Let's hope he found a back way into the castle, because I don't like our chances in a frontal assault."
Gwen and Britt thanked him for the information, and Roy went back to analyzing the castle's defenses.
"Soldiers,"
Roy muttered.
"Four groups, standing 8 abreast, 8 rows deep. Classic phalanx formation. They look well-trained and in good condition. I don't see how we could possibly fight our way through them to the castle, even if we didn't have the women to worry about."
Gwen shook her head and laughed. Britt did not.
"What, women are you worried about, Roy?"
Britt asked.
"I didn't see any standing in front of the castle. Do you think the soldiers' girlfriends are hiding inside the castle?"
Roy groaned.
Gwen said, "He thinks they're in there cooking dinner, and when he and Martin kill all the big, scary men, they'll come running out with their frying pans and rolling pins, and he and Martin will be defenseless, because they could never hit a lady."
Roy turned to face Britt and Gwen. He rubbed his face with his hand and said,
"Look, girls!"
Britt and Gwen stared at him.
"Sorry. Gals,"
Roy tried. Britt continued to stare. Gwen shook her head.
"Ladies?"
Gwen shook her head again. Roy gritted his teeth and said,
"Look, you too."
Britt continued to stare, but Gwen subtly nodded her head.
"All I meant," Roy continued, "was that getting past those soldiers will be more difficult because we'll want to keep you safe. That's all, I assure you."
Britt smiled mirthlessly.
"That's enough, I assure you."
Roy grimaced and turned his back to continue peering at the soldiers. He hoped this would end the argument. He was disappointed.
"What makes you think it's your duty to keep us safe?"
Britt asked.
Roy said, "Hundreds of years of tradition."
Gwen said, "Roy, come on. The whole reason Britt and I are here is to try to help keep our male friends safe. Besides, haven't Britt and I proven that we're just as good at killing the wolves as you and Martin?"
Roy squinted at the soldiers in the distance.
"Yeah, well, killing a man is very different from killing a wolf. Men are smarter."
Britt said,
"I'm not so sure of that."
Roy scowled over his shoulder at her. Britt cocked her head to the side and looked Roy in the eye.
"I didn't mean to insult you. I didn't mind insulting you, but that's not the point I was trying to make. These wolves we've been fighting, they're not real wolves, right? They're all exactly the same. They always attack the same way. They show up in groups of 2 or more, attack 1 at a time, and die instantly, then dissolve, leaving behind some jerky. Then a while later, 2 wolves will pop up for every 1 we've killed. That's not natural wolf behavior, is it?"
"No," Roy admitted. "We've been through this. The wolves are artificial, set up as part of the quest."
"And so were the miners. And so are the soldiers," Britt said. "So I see no reason to believe that they'll be smarter or harder to kill than the wolves are."
Roy furrowed his brow and turned back to look at the soldiers.
"Well, they do all seem to be the same height and build. It's hard to tell from this distance, with them all wearing armor, but they may be identical."
The prospect of having to hack and slash their way through all of those soldiers, even 1 at a time, gave them plenty to think about while Martin worked his way around the far cliff wall. Happily, he had stopped wearing his silver robe and hat. Unlike Roy's trench coat, Martin's robe was not practical attire for wilderness survival and would have made him far too visible. Since he had no powers here, regardless of whether he wore his robes or not, that was 3 strikes. Instead, his robe was folded neatly in his backpack, in case they needed to use it as a blanket or a signal. When he was directly across the river from the others, they all headed back upstream to meet him at the narrow spot where he had crossed the river, leaping from rock to rock. Martin rejoined them, sharing what he'd learned as they walked back toward the castle. It was not good news.
"There are no rocks at all on the far side of the castle,"
Gwen asked. "Could we swim it?" Martin shook his head.
"No way! The current's way too fast. You could get into the water, and you might be able to keep your head above water, but by the time you swam to the other side of the river, you'd be half a mile downstream, and the banks look to be nothing but rock walls. Well, you just leave a streak of claw marks if you tried to climb out."
"Okay," Roy said. "So we know they didn't get in that way."
"Yep," Martin said. "But we aren't sure that they didn't try. There were footprints, lots of them, leading all the way around back, down to the riverbank and back up. If they didn't try to cross back there, they at least seriously considered it."
Britt said, "Well, I'm sure they thought about it, but they wouldn't have actually gotten into that river. They're not idiots." After a moment, she corrected herself.
"They're not all idiots."
After another moment, she said, "Of course, they're all capable of idiocy, we all are, but they wouldn't risk their lives over it."
"Probably."
Roy said, "Getting down to brass tacks, we can't get in the back way, so the main road and through those soldiers is the only way we're going to get in there and get that canary."
"Which the miners already have," Martin added.
"Well," Roy said, "we'll see."
"We already saw," Martin said. "We all saw the canary. The miners already have it."
Britt said, "Yes, but we have to go through the motions to get credit for retrieving it so we can get our next instructions. Honestly, Martin, you know this."
"Yeah," Martin said. "I just wanted to hear someone say it out loud again. It's fun listening to intelligent people talk nonsense as if it's perfectly reasonable. Speaking of which, Roy, what's the plan once we get back to the castle?"
Roy said, "I figure you and I'll leave the ladies back on the path, hidden around the corner. Then we'll walk up to the soldiers, ask them to let us in, then fight our way through them if they don't."
Martin turned to Britt, smiling.
"See? He said that as if it were perfectly reasonable. Isn't that amazing?"
Britt said,
"Amazing. Roy, why do you think you should leave half of the team behind before you go into battle?"
Roy said, "Division of labor. We do our job, you do yours."
"And, what, pray tell, is our job in this situation?"
Roy said, "I don't know. I'm not your boss. I'm not going to tell you what to do."
Britt said, "You're just going to tell us what not to do, and when not to do it, and where to stand while we don't do it?"
Roy said, "You can look at it that way if you want to. I know I'm not trying to order you around. We'll discuss it later. Wait here."
Roy walked around the corner, into view of the soldiers guarding the castle entrance. Martin shared a meaningful look with Gwen, then nodded to Britt, who shook her head. Martin walked quickly to catch up with Roy. They were walking along a couple hundred yards of narrow path on a precariously narrow strip of land, bordered on each side by raging torrents of water, toward a small army of heavily armed men. They had good reason to walk slowly.
"I swear," Roy muttered, "that girl's gonna drive me nuts."
Martin said,
"I think the feeling's mutual."
Roy said,
"I'm just trying to keep them safe. That's what a man does, isn't it? Try to keep the women and children safe?"
Martin nodded.
"Yes. Historically speaking, that's what men do."
"Then why are they fighting me?"
"Because they resent it. Historically speaking, that's what women do when you treat them like children."
"I'm not treating them like children. I'm treating them like ladies."
"Yeah," Martin said. "I noticed. You even keep calling them that. Ladies. Sometimes even young ladies."
"So what's wrong with that?" Roy asked. "That's a compliment."
"Not coming from you."
"Why not?"
Martin sighed.
"Because they think that you think you're better than them, So, coming from you, ladies is an insult, and young ladies is a condescending insult.
That's a bunch of hooey, Roy groaned.
Martin decided to try a different approach.
Have you ever had someone in a position of power over you call you a lady?
Yeah. My drill sergeant used to call us ladies all the time.
Did he mean it as a compliment?
No, of course not, Martin. But that was different. We were...
Men, Roy, you find being called a lady insulting. How do you think it sounds when you call someone else one?
Okay, Roy said. I get it. Everything I'm doing is wrong. What do you suggest?
You're overthinking this. Just treat them like equals.
Roy said,
I don't treat my equals well.
Okay, yeah, Martin agreed. Point taken. Look, don't suck up to them or anything. It'll just seem insincere. Give them credit where it's due. Don't compliment them for no reason. Just try to stop insulting them for no reason.
They walked in silence. Martin thought,
poor Roy, what a terrible situation he's gotten himself into.
A few steps later, Martin thought,
and I'm following him. Things aren't looking so good for me either, are they?
Martin looked to the side, downriver. As he described earlier, the river got still narrower and faster, squeezing itself between two vertical rock walls before disappearing around a bend in the distance. To fall in the river off either side of the path would mean being swept down there to whatever waited around that bend. Martin shuddered at the thought. They had closed half the distance to the soldiers, and it was already clear that they were indeed many copies of the same person. The same large, menacing, angry person. Martin said,
Man, I hope this works.
You hope what works?
Roy asked.
Your plan?
Martin explained. Roy said,
I don't have a plan.
Then why am I following you?
Martin asked.
Because you don't have a plan either.
Well,
Martin said, looking at the looming soldiers.
I guess we still have a few seconds to come up with one.
They walked, both locked in thought, as they closed the remaining gap between them and the motionless soldiers. At the last possible moment, Martin whispered,
Okay, I've got something. Follow my lead and be ready to run.
Roy doubted that any of the great plans in military history had included the phrase, be ready to run. But he didn't have any better ideas, which was all the more reason to be ready to run. Martin strode purposefully toward the front row of soldiers, stopping barely 2 feet in front of one in the middle of the row. Martin looked the clone in the eye, having to look up at a fairly sharp angle to do so, and said,
We've come to enter the castle. Free the canary. Oban is his name, I think. And then we'll be on our way.
The soldier looked down at Martin and said,
None shall pass.
Martin smirked over his shoulder at Roy, nodded, then turned back to the soldier. Martin set his jaw, gave the guard a look of steely determination, then kicked the guard in the crotch and shouted,
Run, Roy, run!
Martin turned to sprint away and was surprised to see that Roy was already several steps ahead of him. Clearly, Roy had been ready to run.
Good to know he can follow directions, Martin thought.
Roy shouted back over his shoulder,
Okay, what now?
Martin glanced behind them and saw just enough to be sure they were being chased.
Keep running!
Martin yelled.
That's your plan?
Roy shrieked.
Keep running?
Would you rather stop?
Martin asked. Martin risked a longer look over his shoulder and was delighted by what he saw.
Good news! Like 8 of them are chasing us!
That's good news?
Yes!
Martin gasped, beginning to run out of wind.
It means that when we get them over to where the girls are, we can gang up on them!
Roy wheezed.
4 of us ganging up on 8 of them!
Yes, they're running identically like the wolves do!
Martin said between gulps of breath.
Odds are they'll take turns fighting, just like the wolves. We won't!
Yeah!
Roy barked.
I get it! Hope the girls are ready!
Martin gasped.
Gwen knows me. She's probably been ready for this since we walked away.
The path widened, then a ridge formed to Martin and Roy's left that grew quickly into a canyon wall as they ran. They could see the point up ahead where the wall seemed to end, but actually turned left, hiding what was waiting around the bend. From a distance, Martin had seen the tops of Gwen's and Britt's heads as they looked around the corner, but as they got closer, the heads had vanished. Martin told Roy to take the corner wide. Roy waved a hand dismissively, rather than wasting his breath, saying, "Way ahead of you." Roy shot past the corner of the canyon wall, almost to the edge of the path, before turning left and continuing down the trail. Martin followed suit, and as he rounded the corner, he could see that Gwen was waiting with her back to the canyon wall and her sword poised like a baseball bat. Britt was beside her, slightly farther down the trail, holding her sword almost like a pitchfork. Martin skidded to a stop, barely avoiding running into Roy, who had also slid to a disorganized halt. They looked back. For a panicked moment, Martin thought that Gwen and Britt had misjudged how close behind them the soldiers were, but as was often the case when Martin thought that Gwen had made a mistake, she had simply thought things through a little more fully than he had. The 8 soldiers were running in a single-file line. The first soldier ran straight past Gwen without ever seeing her. He did notice Britt, even before she ran him through with her sword. He let out a pained scream that harmonized sickeningly with the yelp of surprise that came from the second soldier in line as Gwen chopped him in half at the navel. The 2 halves of the bisected soldier fell to the ground around the first soldier's feet as Britt pulled her sword from his gut. The first soldier fell to his knees among the parts of his comrade before slumping to the ground and being covered by the body of the 3rd soldier in line, whom Gwen had nearly decapitated with her next swing. There was little blood and no gore, but the pile of dead fake soldier parts was still not a pretty sight. Roy and Martin both made involuntary sounds. Roy's was one of shock and amazement, Martin's delight, and more than a little pride. While the remaining soldiers rounded the corner and froze in horror at what remained of their 3 cohorts, Gwen and Britt fell back to Martin and Roy's position, emitting squeaky little sounds of surprise and disgust as they stepped around the body parts of the fallen.
"Well done!" Martin said. Gwen said, "It wasn't that hard. The swords don't feel any resistance when you stab them, and they die after 1 hit."
Martin and Roy had recovered enough to have gotten their swords out. Britt and Gwen flanked them so that they presented a unified, sword-wielding front. The 5 remaining soldiers, who were still standing in single file, looked up from their fallen comrades. The soldier in front drew his sword, bent at the knees, stood sideways, and waved his sword menacingly. The 4 soldiers behind him did the same. They had the same posture and made the same motions at the same speed. The only thing that kept it from looking like a choreographed dance routine was that they all started the animation at slightly different times, so their sword waving was slightly out of sync. The front soldier let out a triumphant "ha-ha!" and lunged forward. His sword met Martin's, and the 2 froze there for a moment, locked in honorable combat, before both Britt and Roy stabbed the soldier with their swords. The soldier fell back, next to the remains of his fallen fellows, who were already beginning to fade and disappear, leaving their mostly unused weapons behind. The next soldier in line said, "Ha!" and lunged for Martin, who parried his thrust and held him there while Roy stabbed him. Britt said, "Rotate," since they all, even Roy, had played volleyball. They knew instinctively to move around in a circle to allow everyone to see an equal amount of action and get an equal amount of rest. They had all taken a step just in time for the next soldier to yell, "Ha-ha!" and lunge at Britt, who had taken over Martin's position. Gwen stabbed him, and as she withdrew her blade, Martin shoved him back onto the fading pile. By the time the 8th soldier attacked, they had the process fairly fine-tuned. They looked at the pile of carnage for a moment and briefly discussed any way they could improve the system. Then Martin said,
"I'd better go get the next row headed this way. We have to get through all of them before this row regenerates twofold."
About an hour later, Four very tired adventurers pushed open the doors of Castle Cragganmore. Their arms felt like spaghetti, and they were drenched with sweat, but they were alive, and the soldiers who had stood in their way were not. They opened the doors wide enough to walk through, but the doors themselves were so large that they appeared to have only opened a crack. A thin shaft of daylight sliced through the darkness, paradoxically making it harder to see what was in the room, not easier. They pushed the doors closed again behind them, just in case the soldiers respawned in their original positions, rather than, like the wolves, where they'd been killed. Once the doors were closed, their eyes could adjust to the light that filtered in through the stained glass windows. There were large, decorative torches on every wall, but as it was still day, they were not lit. There was more than enough light to see by. It just did not seem like it at first, because everything visible was dark. Dark stone floors, supporting dark stone walls, beneath a dark stone ceiling, all illuminated by dark stained glass windows. The room was large and circular, with two symmetrical staircases leading to a nonsensically placed terrace at the back of the room. Beneath the terrace, there was a stone carving of what appeared to be a circular aperture, flanked by two large decorative mirrors. In the middle of the floor, two raised platforms held two levers. Britt shook her head and said,
"Look at this place."
Martin said, "I know!" Britt smirked at him before sighing.
"I've never understood why men think all you have to do to make something cool is to make it big and paint it black."
Martin said,
"I never understood why women think it's more complicated than that."
They shared a small chuckle, then turned their attention to Roy, who was standing on one of the two small platforms in the middle of the room, pushing on the lever that seemed to be the platform's reason for existing.
"Hey, Martin," Roy said. "Why don't you apply a little elbow grease to that other lever? Let's see if we can make something happen."
Britt silently walked toward the second lever. Roy said,
"I said..."
"My elbows are just as greasy as his," Britt said.
She stepped up onto the platform and grasped the lever with both hands. Roy said,
"On three?"
Britt replied,
"That works."
Roy counted, and as he said,
"Three!"
they both easily pushed their levers forward. The room filled with the sound of giant, heavy stones sliding against each other as the stone aperture opened. Britt and Roy made eye contact and in unison started to release their levers, which instantly caused the portal to close. They quickly pushed their levers forward again and the portal reopened. Britt said,
"Okay, I guess we're staying here. Gwen, Martin, you're up. I know you two haven't really been alone for a long time, but please don't spend too much time in there making out."
Gwen and Martin approached the threshold and saw a stone staircase and a seemingly infinite row of torches stretching off into the distance. After a quick promise to not waste too much time, they started down the stairs. After they'd gone far enough that they were sure they wouldn't be overheard, Gwen said,
"We should try to get back to them as quickly as we can. Poor Britt. She can't be happy stuck up there with Roy."
Martin said,
"Yeah. I don't think it's a picnic for Roy, either." "I thought you liked Britt."
"I do. I like her a lot.
And I actually think Roy thinks quite a bit of her, but just shows it badly."
Gwen said,
"He treats her like a weakling and bosses her around."
Martin smiled and said,
"Like I said, badly."
"That's not badly," Gwen said. "That's oppositely, if that's even a word."
Martin attempted to let the topic drop. He was not successful. After a few steps, Gwen said,
"Seriously, Martin, you're saying that he treats Britt and me like idiots because he likes us?"
"That isn't quite what I was saying," Martin said. "But yes, he thinks he's being strong and protective. If he didn't think you both deserved protection and strength, he wouldn't bother."
"So he thinks he should treat us like precious porcelain figurines."
Martin shrugged.
"I think he'd say he's trying to treat you like ladies."
Gwen looked at Martin in disbelief.
"Martin, you agree with him, don't you?"
Martin stopped walking and turned to face Gwen.
"Look, that's not a fair question, and you know it."
"Why not?"
Gwen asked.
"Because you're asking for a yes or no answer to a multiple choice question."
Gwen said,
This isn't the SAT, Martin. Martin said, I know. I did well on my SAT.
Gwen didn't laugh or even smile, but she did noticeably relax, which was enough encouragement for Martin to continue.
Look, he said, you and I are from 2012. Britt's from the 1990s. Roy was born in something like 1930. Think about that for a minute.
Gwen said, that doesn't justify his attitude.
No, Martin said, but it explains it. Gwen, I look at you and Britt and I see modern women. He looks at you and he sees creatures from the friggin' future, a future he can barely imagine. He came here from the 70s. Do you know how awful things were back then? The women Roy's friends would have considered crazy, hardcore feminists were demanding jobs. That's it. Jobs that weren't nursing, sewing, or food service. They weren't even demanding equal pay yet, because they wanted to be realistic.
Martin continued down the stairs. Gwen followed.
So, what are you telling me?
Gwen asked.
Britt and I should take his behavior as a compliment? Should we thank him for belittling us?
Not at all, Martin said. I think you both have played things about right. What's that called when psychologists electrocute you when you do something wrong? Abhorrent conditioning, I think? Anyway, he won't learn that he's doing the wrong thing unless you two show him that he is. So I say, keep up the good work.
I'd just appreciate it if you try not to hate him.
He's a grumpy old cuss, but he's not a bad guy. It's not that he doesn't respect you. He just respects you wrong.
At last, they reached the bottom of the stairs and found themselves in a large room. The center of the room was a statue of a six-armed warrior. In his six hands, he brandished six knives, the blades of which were polished to a mirror finish. On the far wall, there was an intricately carved door that was covered with strange symbols. On each side of the door, there were three stone cylinders, about the height of a man, which also held carved hieroglyphics, though much larger than the ones on the doors. In front of both sets of cylinders, there was a rail holding a small mirror. Along the sides of the room, six braziers held six roaring fires, the light from which was focused by large lenses toward the statue in the middle of the room. Gwen and Martin surveyed the scene silently for a moment. Then Gwen said,
Puzzle. Obviously, Martin replied. I'll take the left side, Gwen said. You take the right.
Martin said, Cool. And they went about their work. The statue stood in an exaggerated squat that looked fearsome and allowed people of normal human height to use its legs as a place to stand. Gwen and Martin climbed up on the statue's bent knees and started pulling on the arms, each of which were attached to the torso via a swivel joint at the shoulder. Each arm easily swung into position with a satisfying click, and the light from one of the braziers, focused by the lenses, reflected off the dagger blades to illuminate one of the symbols on the door. In short order, they had all six arms in position and six glyphs highlighted. They moved on to the cylinders, which turned smoothly but slowly. Martin spun the columns until the three symbols displayed on their fronts matched the three illuminated on the door closest to him. He turned to check on Gwen's progress and found her smirking at him with her arms crossed.
You done? He asked.
Yep, she answered.
Martin said.
Then why isn't the door opening?
He pushed and pulled on the door. It didn't move.
Are you done with your side?
Gwen asked.
Martin said, Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yes,
Martin said.
I think.
He looked at the cylinders. The markings matched. He thought for a moment, casting his eyes around the room.
The mirror!
Martin moaned.
I totally forgot about the mirror!
Martin stood between the cylinders and the mirror, then swung the mirror around so he was looking at the cylinders. And of course, when looked at this way, the symbols were backward and in the wrong order. He spun the first cylinder until he found a glyph that was the reversed version of the symbol on the last cylinder. Gwen smiled approvingly. As he arranged the other two cylinders, Martin said,
I gotta admit, These puzzles are a lot more tiring when you're actually physically doing them, instead of sitting on your couch with a controller, watching Lara Croft do the work.
Tomb Raider, huh? Gwen said. I preferred Uncharted.
Well, I'm a dude, and Lara Croft is fun to look at.
I'm a chick, and I feel the same way about Nathan Drake.
Martin shrugged and continued spinning the cylinders.
And Victor Sullivan?
Gwen continued. Martin turned to face her, grinning.
Really? The old guy?
Yeah, why not? Age differences like that don't always bother women. Look at Philip and Britt.
Martin said.
Britt's older than Philip.
Mentally, Gwen said. Physically, she's much younger.
Martin said.
Age differences like that don't always bother men. Almost never, in fact.
Martin slid the last glyph into place, and the doors swung open on their own. Gwen and Martin crept into the dark passage beyond the door. The only sound was the rustling of their own clothing. They could see a well-lit room waited at the end of the hall, but there was no source of light between there and where they were. As they approached the light, their view of the room grew wider and cleared. They saw a fortune in gold and other assorted loot, piled and heaped in such large amounts that it couldn't help but look terribly fake. In the midst of the gold, there was a throne. The arms of the throne and its backrest, seat cushion, and the floor around it were stained with blood, in such large amounts of it that it couldn't help but look terribly real. Across from the throne, there was a table, and on that table, there was a familiar-looking ornate metal birdcage. Inside the birdcage, there was an ornate metal bird, just like the one back at the mine, except this one was not moving, seemingly frozen in mid-flutter. It hung motionless in the air, beak open, wings outstretched. On the floor just behind the table, there was the body of a portly man in a filthy jester costume, lying motionless, arms akimbo, and face down on the floor with his head turned away. There was no sign of blood, gore, or decomposition of any kind, and he was clearly not a real person. That only made the sight of him more disturbing. Anyone involved in a healthy, long-term romantic relationship can tell when their partner wants to leave a place. Usually the place in question is some place the other person does not want to leave. A party, a Broadway musical, or a sports bar with scantily clad waitresses. In this case, both Martin and Gwen were able to tell that neither of them felt like hanging around. So they simply walked in, grabbed the cage, and walked out again, without ever having to discuss it. Britt shifted her weight, adjusting her stance so that the lever's handle dug into a different part of her anatomy. Using her body weight to hold the door open didn't require a lot of strength, but it still had its cost. Early on, she had been forced to make a choice. She could have a single, smallish bruise that went clear to the bone, or she could spread the damage around and end up with a less painful bruise that had more surface area. Once she was confident with her new position, she turned her attention back to the conversation at hand.
So, she asked, about the SR-71. I understand that the friction of the speeds it flew caused so much expansion that the skin panels had to be made smaller than usual, and that at room temperature the whole plane had big, honking panel gaps.
Yep. If you look too closely, it looked like we'd had the thing built by British Leyland.
Roy was sitting on the floor, leaning back on his lever as if it were a backrest.
That's a car company that makes crummy cars.
Yeah, I know, Britt said. They did, anyway. They're long gone in my time.
I'm not surprised. How's a young lady like you know about all this guy stuff?
Britt chose to let the young lady bit slide, and instead focused on how she knew about all this guy stuff.
Roy, she said, I love machines, and engineering, and problem solving. Before I found the file, I was going to be an architect. I know things.
Roy scoffed.
Well, now, I don't know what all you know, but I'll tell you something I know. Saying you are going to be something isn't the same as being that thing.
What's that supposed to mean?
Britt asked, despite the fact that she knew exactly what it was supposed to mean.
Just that reading about building things isn't the same as actually building things. That's all.
Roy explained.
Britt said, I built a city. An entire city. Atlantis. You've been there.
Roy said, yeah, about that. I've always been hazy on how that whole thing happened. When did you build Atlantis?
Britt said, about 40 years from now.
Roy waved his hand dismissively.
Yeah, great, I know. We're all time travelers, great. What I'm asking is, to you, from your point of view, when did you build the city?
That's what I'm trying to tell you, Britt explained. From my point of view, the city will be built 38 years from now.
Roy smiled.
Oh, so what you're saying is that you didn't build Atlantis. Britt the Elder did.
Britt said, she's me!
Roy said, not yet, she isn't.
Britt said, besides, the city is based on my plans and ideas.
Roy said, ugh, ideas don't impress me as much as execution. Sorry, kid, but where I come from, we judge people by what they've done, not what they say they'll do.
I'm not telling you what I will do, Britt said. I'm telling you what I will have done.
Roy mulled this over for a moment, then said,
yeah, well, I don't know what to think of that.
Britt admitted, neither do I, most days.
The conversation might have continued, but they were distracted by the sound of footsteps echoing up the staircase behind them. Roy and Britt glanced at each other, silently confirming that they would enact the plan they had hatched shortly after they'd stopped actively pushing on the levers and had started leaning on them. Roy smiled, Britt nodded, and they both started arranging themselves as discussed. Gwen and Martin walked up the stairs much more slowly than they had walked down. With each step, the light from the door at the top of the stairs grew brighter. The fact that there was light at all was reassuring, as it meant that Britt and Roy were still there to keep the door open. As they reached the last few steps, and their heads rose above the level of the main chamber's floor, they could see Roy and Britt doing their jobs. Roy was leaned over, holding the lever with both hands and bracing it with his shoulder. His knuckles were white with exertion. His feet struggled to find traction in the slick marble floor. Britt had spun around to the other side of her lever and was hanging from it by one elbow, using her other arm to keep herself from slipping. Roy looked up, saw Martin and Gwen, and gasped,
hurry up! We can't hold it forever!
Both Gwen and Martin practically threw themselves through the portal, only taking care to not damage the birdcage with its frozen cargo in the process. They were barely free of the door when Roy rolled sideways off of his lever, allowing it to spring back into its original position. Britt merely let go of her lever, falling to the ground in a panting heap. Martin said,
guys, we're sorry. We went as fast as we could.
Roy massaged his hands. Britt sat up, shoulders sagging, and limply held up a hand, signaling that a response would come when it was darn good and ready. After several heavy breaths, she said,
we know. We know. You did your best, I'm sure. A few times I turned to Roy and I said, we have to hold on. Martin and Gwen are counting on us. Didn't I say that, Roy?
Yeah,
Roy agreed.
I knew she was right, but it took you so long. I was sure something terrible had happened. All we could do was worry and hold on as long as we could.
Martin said, oh, guys, we're sorry. It must have been terrible.
It was,
Britt said.
Roy cried.
Roy instantly looked furious with Britt. Britt looked at him innocently and said,
isn't that right, Roy?
Through gritted teeth, Roy said,
I didn't think you were going to tell them that.
Gwen walked over to Roy and put a hand on his shoulder.
Oh, come on, Roy. It's all right. You have nothing to be ashamed of. I'm sure you cry all the time.
Roy looked up at Gwen and said,
thanks for that.
Martin offered Britt a hand up, which she accepted. Once she was on her feet, Martin asked,
why didn't you just lean back on the lever?
It might have been easier than hanging from it.
Britt said, Really, Martin? You're going to second-guess us? You don't know what went on up here. You don't know what all we tried.
Martin quickly said, You're right, I'm sorry.
Britt glared at him for a moment, then looked down at the birdcage, saying,
So, the bird was there?
Martin said, Yeah, but he's not right. Martin held up the cage so Britt and Roy could get a good look. The metal bird was still frozen in place, hovering in midair above its perch, wings frozen mid-flight. Martin spun the cage around so they could see that the bird remained motionless in relation to the cage, no matter how it moved.
Weird,
Roy said, summing the situation up nicely.
Yeah, Gwen agreed, and it wasn't the only thing that was a bit off. There was a jester down there who didn't seem to be dead or even really hurt. He was just lying perfectly still, face down on the floor.
Britt said, Yeah, that does seem like some kind of glitch. Any sign of what messed things up?
Martin and Gwen exchanged a quick look. Then Martin said,
Well, there was also a lot of blood down there.
The jesters?
Roy asked.
No, Gwen said. It was on the other side of the room.
That silenced all conversation, while they all thought seriously about whose blood it might have been.
Roy said, Speaking of blood, we should get moving. Every second we stay here, the more likely that those soldiers have regenerated.
Martin pushed the immense doors open a crack and peeked through, fearing that he'd find a sea of soldiers all waiting their turn to attack him. Instead, the courtyard was empty. He pushed the door open far enough to poke his head out and look from side to side. He saw nobody. He pushed the doors open and walked out into the open air, followed by the others.
Looks like they haven't regenerated,
Martin said.
At least they haven't regenerated here, Gwen said. Two wolves usually respawn where one was killed, so if the soldiers did come back, there'll be twice as many of them around that corner.
She pointed down the only path leading to or from the castle, which turned left in the distance and went behind the wall of the canyon, creating the natural hiding spot they had used earlier.
Martin said, I'll sneak up there and see if the coast is clear. It's the least I can do after what we put you two through.
Martin jogged away. Roy said,
That's decent of him.
Britt said, Well, I'm sure he feels terrible. He knows it had to be bad if it made a big, strong man like you cry.
Roy grimaced and said, Humph.
Britt said, Like a little girl.
Roy glared at her, then focused on the frozen bird in the cage he was holding. Gwen made eye contact with Britt. Britt shrugged. Gwen continued her eye contact. Britt shrugged again. Gwen raised her eyebrows. Britt blushed a bit and nearly laughed. Gwen nearly laughed too, and might have, if not for the distant yelp and the sight of Martin running their way, pursued by 16 regenerated soldiers.